My name is Vladimir Goldstein. I lived in the United States since 1979, graduated from Columbia and Yale, and now I'm a professor of Slavic studies at Brown University. I was born in Moscow, which I left at the age of 23, and, you know, I was pretty much a foreign person there. I went to Moscow school. I started studying computers and mathematics in Moscow, but then I got very much kind of disappointed with both the subject and life in Moscow and a certain degree of oppression or lack of freedom. So I thought West is the answer. So I just arrived, you know, to the West, and I was pretty lucky, got a good, interesting job, interesting education. But recently I've been haunted by this strange kind of deja vu feeling that, you know, something which I, from what I ran away from in Soviet Union is being replayed as a bad nightmare in front of my own eyes. So that's
my God, well, that's frightening, isn't it? But can you just say something about, you know, you at age 23, what year was that, and what was going on at the time politically? That's a fascinating something that, you know, you as a young man suddenly decide, right, I've had enough of this, I'm going to do a bit of, and it's, of course, this is something which happens with lots and lots of particularly young men around the world, is they decide, right, before I settle down, before I, you know, absolutely establish myself in a career, I want to make sure I've seen a bit of the world first. And it's brilliant that in the modern world it is possible to do this. But so what, can you just tell us about what happened to you and what it really inspired you, age 23?
Well, you know, it was 79, and the only way, for starters, if you are a Russian citizen, it was next to impossible to travel, because, you know, basically they didn't want Soviet citizens to go abroad, to see things, to maybe possibly to escape, and so on. So there was limitations there. But there was limitation in terms of many things. If you remember, it was still continuation kind of in the 60s, you know, rock music, fashion, Western films. We had tremendous difficulties kind of watching it. So you would hear about the United States or Great Britain, young people with wild hair. You know, I was going to the college, in the college, and we were forced to cut our hair. I couldn't wear the hair I wanted. You know, for young person, it was important. I had, like, you know, a beautiful black curly hair. I wanted to flaunt it. All that type of thing. Plus, there was, like, really increased kind of unfriendly atmosphere. There was definitely anti-Semitism. I went to a very good mathematical school in Moscow. Then I wasn't accepted to college of my choice, precisely because this college was preparing a lot of people for military, for engineering, and they wouldn't accept Jews. Consequently, Jews were not very happy, and they would sort of emigrate. So it became kind of a vicious circle. So I felt that I wasn't very happy with my education. I wasn't very happy with my freedoms. I felt stifled by absolutely kind of boring, repetitive, uniform discourse on TV, only like virtues of Soviet Union, only vices of the West, only, you know, constant fear. There was still, you remember, some kind of denunciation, Solzhenitsyn writes something, he's an enemy. So the dissent was suppressed, and people practiced a lot of self-censorship, which I hated. You want to exchange views, you want to read, you want to think, you want to get books of your own. We had, at my time, so-called Tamizdat and Samizdat. This is publications which were either published in the West, smuggled in, or copied and given. It's more or less like some alternative press nowadays. You cannot get access to main information. You get deplatformed by Facebook, so you sort of find alternative channels. That's exactly what it was at that time. I remember somebody gives me a copy of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita for one day, Bulgakov's Master and Margarita for one night. I have to return it. So, you know, who needs that? You know, you need the life of ideas. You need, you know, a lot of freedom.
Well, yeah, but I've got to ask you, you know, first of all, what was your vision of what the West was like? And did it actually fulfill what you believed its potential was when you decided to leave?
I think, actually, don't forget that I was a young person, 23, and my vision was, like, you know, colors, first of all, colors. you know, relative friendliness, because, you know, the 70s in Russia, people were kind of pretty grim, unhappy. Economy wasn't doing very well. So there was unfriendliness, kind of grayness, you know, and, you know, no music, which I like, no this and that. So, you know, I was pretty happy when I arrived to the West. And plus, you know, I went to Columbia. I got pretty good education. Only with you know, as time unfolds, I began to see sort of, you know, rather big issues. And especially the first round of lying, which was for me a very rude awakening. Maybe other people have rude awakening later. For me, it came in 1995, this period when out of the blue, Serbia is being bombed by NATO and declared the enemy, even though sort of I have Serbian friends. I know the reality. They were not the enemy. There was a complicated situation, but yeah. Somehow I saw how one particular nation, be it, you know, Jews under Germany, be it sort of foreigners under Soviets, be it sort of, you know, any other undesirable nation, they are appointed bad guys, and the whole NATO start bombing, and, you know, there was total uniformity. I remember I was very angry, and at that time I was a professor at Yale, and I write letters to the nation, to New York Times. Nobody publishes, nobody, God forbid, you want to say something different. And for the first time, I felt absolutely silenced, like some my dissident friends back in Moscow.
So that so that's the breakup of Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, by NATO. Yes, there's a lot of people have pointed to that as a very important episode where this was an example which was not under a strict Soviet system. It was much more relaxed than and of course there was the famous standoff between Tito and the Soviets, you know, where Tito dared them to invade him, you know, after the Second World War. So they were an independent state. Absolutely. So look, but before we go on, can you just, are you allowed to give away some trade secrets about how you actually managed to get out of the Soviet Union and how easy or difficult that was?
All right, that's a very good question. It's not that complicated. Again, you know, on many levels, I mentioned that at my time there was like kind of a certain anti-Semitism, and Jews were not accepted to good colleges or it was sometimes good jobs. But on the other hand, Jews had an opening; they could emigrate because there was this politics between, you know, Russia and United States and Carter and all this kind of pressure. Was like, you know, you will improve trade relationship provided you allow Russian Jews emigrate. So luckily, we had some distant relative living in Israel, my family, and he sent to us an invitation that come to Israel, visit us, and stay with us. And, you know, we after 9 or 10 months waiting, my family got a permission to emigrate, as opposed to many common Russians who just couldn't. They wanted to. So, of course, you're probably familiar with all the sort of tricks when people will try to get married, to get out. But at my time, practically the only legitimate way to get out is on this Israeli visa. So my parents went to Israel. I, however, wasn't particularly crazy about that. I wanted to study, and I knew English, and I also had my particular vision. I wanted sort of to go to university, and I thought to go to Israel and to study foreign language and, you know, go to the army, which, you know, people supposed to go. It wasn't sort of, you know, I wasn't very much kind of keen on this idea. So we flew to Vienna, and in Vienna we split. My parents went to Israel. And I went to United States.
Anyway, I know you're making some comparisons between, you're beginning to anyway now, after Yugoslavia, seeing that the West isn't necessarily as free as you thought it was going to be. And of course, things have gone downhill quite a bit since then.
Absolutely. It was, you know, what shocked me the most about Yugoslavia is absolute lack of alternative points of view of a debate. Somehow I felt like in the Soviet Union. Now they declared that Czech Republic is under control of capitalists. We have to invade, and whoever would say no would be arrested and silenced. The same thing happened with Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia and Milosevic is a bad guy. They're killing people, and we have to go and invade and bomb them. So this what scared me is absolutely kind of almost like metal kind of jacket. You cannot break through that. You try to say something different. Once in a while, there was some kind of alternative voices, but they were just silenced very rapidly. And then we see how the West realized that Russia, you know, is weak. You know, Russia traditionally defends Serbia and Yugoslavia. They couldn't do anything. So that actually opened the hands. And then the realization, Soviet Union used to play an important role in Middle East when they were trying to defend sort of, you know, Arab states, you know, and so on, or Yugoslavia. At that moment, with Russia doing nothing in terms of Yugoslavia, I guess Westerners just woke up in their worst appetites, in their worst aggression, and said, okay, it's free for all. We can just bomb and invade anything. And we know history, then we have this fake Trump-up accusations against Iraq, and then bombing of Libya, and then it continued. And another sort of thing which totally threw me off and got me absolutely kind of angry is the situation with Ukraine, when I know very well for sure how complicated it is, how split the country is between East Ukraine and West Ukraine, how complicated the situation is, how Eastern Ukraine does want to join the Western Ukraine, want to be part of Russia, and so on. And we, here in the West, the same story. You know, great Ukrainians are fighting for democracy, evil Putin intervening and doing, and this is absolutely unrelated to truth. And it's the same story I've got in the Soviet Union by Brezhnev, that what we're doing, we're helping our friendly Czech people by invading them. We're helping our friendly Hungarian people by invading them. This is absolutely deja vu all over again. And people are silenced. People are afraid to question or criticize. Or they just basically immediately turned into, like in my time in Soviet Union, if you say something in Soviet Union, you're accused of being agent of NATO, agent of CIA. Here, if you say something kind of which questions the party line, you're accused of being Putin's bot, Putin's stooge, and absolutely the same methods.
Yeah, so we've just had World Press Freedom Day last week, and it's virtually zero mention of either that or Julian Assange in the Western press. And certainly many of my journalistic colleagues are watching very, very closely what's happening to him, because we've noticed that he has really spilled the beans on some of the most horrific war crimes. But not only that, the fact that much of the state apparatus in the West is being used to actually spy on citizens, but also to spy on these kind of protected groups like politicians, journalists and lawyers too.
That's all very, very sad and very, very disturbing, because when I was growing up in Russia, you know, we all hear of how evil KGB is spying on its own citizens, controlling, directing, you know, making visits to the editors of newspapers when they publish something which is a little bit deviated from party line. But we realize, now I realize that the scope of, you know, CIA penetration here, it might be even deeper than, you know, KGB at its worst day. You know, this is not right, you know, the way Snowden and Assange are treated. Instead of just making corrections and improving things, the West persists, digs its heels. And that's, for me, it's a sign actually of declining regime. You know, we know what's important for, as far as I'm concerned, that Soviet Union was actually in the state of collapse. That, you know, all these things which I've seen now, that, of course, you know, 30 years later, they call it period of stagnation. You know, during Brezhnev and all these geriatric leaders, you know, senile, demented leaders. But we have in the West now something similar. You know, it's a sort of economically they're not doing well. They're losing the edge to China. They cannot produce. And we're experiencing some kind of a decline, which, you know, manifests itself in suppression of free speech and persecution of whistleblowers, in public shaming, in fear. So this is kind of very, very, very uncanny and very unpleasant parallels. But, you know, I keep on hearing from many people who lived in under both systems that they experience this feeling of deja vu. I'm not the only one.
No, right. Well, I mean, as someone that's lived in the Soviet Union, are there any techniques you think that we should be using in the West to bypass this propaganda?
I mean, first of all, in Russia, I know, and this is kind of very sad and peculiar, that somehow this, you know, you develop some kind of Aesopian language when you sort of, you try to criticize one obscure country, but everybody knows that you criticize your own. or you try to keep your mouth shut, or you don't approach, you know, people had a phone, like one phone in the apartment, in the kitchen. So if you want to have some kind of conversation, private conversation, you'll be very far away from phone, you know. And where nowadays, you know, if you want to talk about something, you don't bring it on Facebook for fear of being banned or for being deplatformed and so on. You know, I mean, what is interesting, and I think that's probably what alternative press is trying to do. At my time, you know, when we were in the Soviet Union, one source of information was this radio station broadcasting from the West, Voice of America, Free Europe. We know that they were government sponsored. We know that they were not the most objective, but at least they provided an alternative. And you know, I know some people say, "Oh no, no, Voice of America was you know, just paid on the government." But it doesn't matter. If they would invite people who would provide some alternative information, which will go against the mainstream propaganda, you know, Soviet citizens were very happy to listen to that. It doesn't matter where it's coming from. So I think, you know, it's very good that, you know, there are still alternative, you know, ways, you know, that to convey information. You can keep on hearing about, you know, this Greenwald who goes somewhere, radio shows, all this other shows. You know, they have to bring some alternative views. We have to hear about Assange. We have to hear what Snowden knows and so on. So I think it's important.
So did you used to in Russia used to listen, you know, quietly and secretly to these broadcasts, sort of under the bed sheets, quietly, and try and make sure no one knew you were listening, a bit like we used to here in the UK? We used to listen to radio, you know, maybe a bit earlier than that, in the 60s or whatever, listen to Radio Luxembourg, Radio Caroline, Radio Jackie, Radio London, the pirates here.
Absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, and you know, sometimes you wait till the very late at night, because I remember at certain time, you know, if you're living in a communal apartment with the neighbors, you probably don't want to do that at all, because people were afraid. You know, last sort of 5-7 years of my life in Moscow, we had our own apartment, so I tried to listen, but sometimes, you know, 7, 8, 9 in the evening, when you want to hear, they will use all this sort of technology so to blur the sound. But late at night, I guess whether they were economic or this, so sometimes I would wake up at 2 a.m. and there will be BBC telling me. So it's so funny. At that time, I trusted BBC. Now I view BBC is exactly as Pravda.
Oh, so what you're saying is that the signal was being jammed early in the evening, but maybe in the middle of the night, in the early hours of the morning, you might be able to hear it.
Absolutely. That was my experience.
Okay, so with the present whole situation in the West, you really described it, I think, very well, in that you've got the same sort of economic problems as there were in the Soviet Union. Obviously, as people lose their jobs, particularly with the pandemic at the moment, there is a tremendous amount of, you know, small to medium businesses have gone to the wall. The big multinationals, you know, your Amazons and the online businesses, these massive, massive giants have done incredibly well out of this. There's a similar sort of feel to this depression, you know, that the idea that people are just, you know, finding it more and more and more difficult to make a living. The big question, though, I think, is whereabouts do you think this is heading, Vladimir? Because, you know, maybe when you were listening back in 1979, to the Western Radio Free Europe, you didn't realize that, you know, the Iron Curtain was going to fall, that the Berlin Wall was going to go down. So I wonder, can you predict where this is heading? Because, you know, clearly the Chinese are far, far more effective and efficient at building things and making things than the West. And it seems to me that the West is bound to lose this massive trade war.
This is, you know, fascinating questions, and I can say I don't ponder them. I also can say that I know the answer, and you're absolutely correct. In, you know, in 79, when they went to the West, there was a general consensus that Soviet Union will continue. It will continue to decay. It will continue, but it will go on, because people were convinced that they still have enough kind of mechanisms, enough energy, enough of power to go on. But then it's dismantled very rapidly. So, you know, the same feeling here. You know, of course, West has a lot of resources, a lot of know-how, a lot of energetic people. So I wouldn't just dismiss it and say that they're heading into the dustbin of history. But on the other hand, you know, it's clear that they, at least the way they were doing things, without any drastic kind of rethinking, they are getting more and more irrelevant. So, in other words, you know, what fascinates me nowadays about the West is like fixation of this identity wars on some kind of, you know, the main concern of everyone is Oscars and some kind of TV shows that they don't have enough representatives of all kind of minorities. These are important issues. But I think, you know, we have to face like fundamental issues, like in Soviet Union, they had to face, are we as a system viable? What can we do to make it viable? The same thing here. You know, the system which allows, you know, Amazon to become rich and some kind of companies to become rich and then impose some kind of an entity politics on the rest of us as a panacea, I don't think it will succeed. You know, my hope in terms of prediction is that there will be enough people who would wake up in the West under the sort of Chinese, you know, domination, and they would present at least some kind of alternative. It doesn't mean that, you know, any system has to have an upper hand. That's what we have to learn. You know, the people, history, culture, tradition, they can develop in their own way. But I think if the West doesn't do anything, they will collapse like Soviet Union did.
Well, maybe. Look, I mean, we have this May Day bank holiday. At least it used to be called that. They've changed the name of it in the UK now to the early spring bank holiday, and which is really just trying to get rid of any reference to the idea of this being associated with sort of, you know, the Marxists, the Socialist International May Day thing that which goes on in Moscow. But in Moscow it's very, very, very different. You know, it's a big military parade, the latest military technology on display, with the president there saluting the troops, troops saluting back. It's a massive show of force, but it has an extra edge to it this year because we've had this incredible diplomatic spat between the United States and Russia, with initially the Russian ambassador being withdrawn from Washington, and then the other way round, the American ambassador to Moscow being asked to leave. Now, this, I believe, is the first time this has ever happened, that there is no ambassador from Russia in Washington and no American ambassador in Moscow. And I just wonder what you think the significance of that is, because I think it's been downplayed in the Western media.
I think it's significant, but I think West gets as much out of it as possible. They probably enjoy presenting Russia as an enemy, casting Russia as an enemy, going through the motion of doing something. Ultimately, you know, it is a red herring. Because if we go back, Soviet Union was a real powerful system, and it was like on many levels adversary to the West, on economic level, ideological level. Russia is not, absolutely not an adversary to the West. So that basically it's all Trump up charges. You know, they used to blame, in the West, you know, certain minorities, certain this, so that now they cannot do that. So they create their scapegoats in the form of Russia. It's like a way of distracting population, you know, identity politics at home. Russia is an enemy outside. And a pandemic is coming over, so the public is too busy, too scared, too paranoid to ask the government to actually to modernize American type of capitalism, because it's absolutely it needs new thinking, it needs new blood, it needs more government involvement, it needs more government programs. You know, it's absolutely obvious. Now it reaches billionaires in the United States say that. They don't want to do that. So it's much easier to blame Russia and to get the ambassador out. And Russia just probably responds in its kind. I think they're getting more and more kind of disappointed in the West, but, you know, they need to have enough armies. Who knows what kind of, you know, we know that when the West in the 30s began to decay, they ended up with Hitler. So Russia has to be ready. You know, they don't want another decaying NATO kind of system which would decide to invade. So I think they're correct to be prepared. But I think the West using Russia as an enemy is ultimately a red herring, as a way of distracting their own population from real burning issues of the day.
But if you don't mind, I think you've avoided the question there, really, because the idea that there is no longer any diplomatic relations between Washington and Moscow, it surely is unprecedented. This whole situation has obviously been started by Putin in withdrawing his ambassador, and then retrospectively the other way around. We've also seen lots of expulsions of diplomats. We've seen many of the correspondents from the various TV networks. It really does look as if there are very clear messages being sent one way or the other way, that there literally is no diplomatic relationship. And in that sort of situation, anything can happen. I mean, we've got this. Various flashpoints around the world, where obviously it's going to be very, very important that there's that hotline between Washington and Moscow.
This is very important, but I think, you know, I don't think I was avoiding, but I think what is happening now, I'm not surprised, because this recalling of ambassadors is more or less making explicit which was implicit, because that was kind of Russians were concerned many times, you know, for many, many years, ever since probably Ukraine, for sure, when, you know, there was a certain moment when Merkel said that Putin lives on a different planet, to which Russia says, no, you guys live on a different planet. We are neighbors, relatives, parents, children of people who live in Ukraine. We know what's going on there. Don't tell us what's not going on. And the West would say something different. So there's total failure to see eye to eye. So, you know, there's a very famous term which Lavrov, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, introduced, недоговороспособный. This is a very long Russian word. They're incapable of any kind of agreements. So I think that's what Russians formulated about the West, which basically cannot agree on anything. So having ambassadors was just basically, ambassadors were this kind of, this not a real role, because they were not capable of communicating.
No, okay, I understand. Yeah, I mean, I think you've explained yourself very well. But I mean, you know, to me, this is almost unthinkable. You know, something like Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis could happen now, and there's no proper diplomatic relations, which is quite a frightening prospect. But anyway, look, you've talked quite a lot about this identity politics, and I find this quite fascinating too. I suppose because what you've got is an almost obsession with equality, and that's not, you know, in terms of, you know, proper balance, but it's almost a kind of numerical equality where you must have X number of women, X number of men, Y number of men, you know, X number of same-sex couples, Y number, you know, almost like that. That is the way equality is being framed. And yet the imbalance between rich and poor is expanding at a massive rate. And this is actually the most important equality, is whether you can feed your family and feed yourself or not.
This is absolutely excellent point. That is, you know, so we came up again with this red herring equality, like at the expense of real equality. So you can live in this absolutely sort of awful conditions. You have difficulties getting good access to medicine or job, but you know, people who look like you, who might happen to be like from some minorities, they are getting awards in Oscars. And you should be happy for that. You know, it's ridiculous. You know, if your family is crying and doesn't have food on the table, you know, even if somebody who looks exactly like you gets an Oscar and gets a chance to buy another mansion in Hollywood, I don't think it makes you warmer or give you a better shelter. So it's like a hypocrisy. But what is interesting, we had the same hypocrisy under Brezhnev in the Soviet Union. It was the same thing. You know, certain people would say wouldn't have access to job, wouldn't have prosperity growth, but there was numerical, exactly like you said, there should be numerical orders that certain amount of people from that republic should be a position in this power, certain amount of this. So there was a book about Soviet Union about 1930s, which was called Affirmative Action Empire. So Soviets, they went through that. When they tried to sort of, you know, to have the Stalinism at the expense of real equality.
Now, in the background to all of the international tensions, you know, between Moscow and Washington, we've got quite a lot of problems going on down in Israel and Palestine. One of the latest is from the London Independent newspaper, is saying that the UN is warning of all-out war, in inverted commas, as the death toll hits 62, with 15 children killed as well. Now, I mean, this sort of conflict has been going up and down for years. We've had some horrific assaults, mainly, you know, killing Palestinians over the last couple of decades. And I just wonder what you make of what's going on at the moment, and if there's anything you can say about that. And also, of course, we have a major problem in, I think, in the UK, and you can comment on this too, which is that the conflict is being framed in the press here as something that Israel as a state is having to react to something which has been started by Hamas. Now, you know, you and I know, and most of us know, that things are rarely that simple. So I just wonder what you can make of what the conflict and tension, which has been going on over nearly a week now in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we probably should go back again to the such a sad, you know, event as collapse of the Soviet Union. I have a good friend of mine who formulated very well that Soviets were the first to lose Cold War, and the West is the second one. So, you know, what's important is, you know, we all know that to have some kind of a balance of power. And we had, you know, Russia, who would can sort of say, be there, and Russia is very much directly related to Middle East, it's closer to Middle East, you know, and China and United States, then they can sort of sit together and, you know, more or less direct all the plans. With the collapse of Soviet Union and withdrawal of Soviet Union from international affairs at that moment, we basically have United States, which allows Israel to do anything they want. And, you know, so the voice of Arabs, the Arabs are more or less were left to themselves to fend for themselves, as opposed to sort of before that, at least there was some kind of balance of power. And balance of power, it might be we might complain about, you know, Soviet supporting certain kind of dictators and Americans and other ones, but at least there was some peace. And there is, you always like to this, you know, old proverb that bad peace is better than a good war. So, but now we have all the chances for a good war. That is, you know, the Soviets, you know, they probably, Soviets and Chinese should be brought in, and they should sort of argue and represent the interest of all the players in the region, outside countries, you know, Palestinians from outside Israel, within Israel. They have to be heard, because otherwise we basically have the same unfortunate situation or the same narrative, American-driven, sort of Israel-driven, bad Palestinians and victim Israelis. And I agree with you, situation is much more complicated. For starters, you know, a lot of Palestinians are treated as second rate. They feel that they are second rate, and they don't have very frequently, they resort, as people in despair, they resort to desperate actions. This desperate action, if somebody taunts and teases you, whatever, you might in anger grab a bottle and hit it. And then somebody makes a picture of you hitting somebody and say, what an awful person. But, you know, people don't consider the background of it, that you know, Palestinians, a lot of Palestinians are driven to despair. So I think, you know, I wish there would be, as you said, that we need more diplomacy. Biden should probably bring Putin, should probably bring Chinese, should bring other leaders, and they have to talk and bring some kind of resolution. But without it, it will be the same narrative. Anybody who criticizes Israel will be accused of being, you know, kind of anti-Semite, support of terrorists, and this is very one-sided. So, in terms of what's going on in England, yeah, I remember there was a situation in England when the leader of Labour was immediately just accused for being anti-Semite, for being sympathetic to Palestinian side. And this is two different issues. You can be anti-Semite and not be sympathetic to a Palestinian side. You can be absolutely kind of admirer of Jewish people and sympathetic to a Palestinian side. But somehow the merging of these issues is it's another thing which bugs me about, as I said, you know, anyone who criticizes the West now is Putin bot. Putin stooge. In my time, everybody who would criticize Soviet Union will be CIA agent, fascist collaborator, and so on. So this simplification, this Manichaean wall of dividing of the world into black and white is not right. It's absolutely kind of abusive, and it's a sign of, I think, is a decline and more contortions and more violence. And that's what we might see in terms of like the whole war in the region. I don't think it will unfold, unfortunately, you know, because the forces are not equal. So there will be, you know, there will be violence until somebody saying it will stop it. But
yeah, one of the things that's been going on in the UK, Vladimir, is that we anyone that is criticizing the media, saying the media is biased in favor of Israel, is also many people are actually also being accused of saying, well, you're anti-Semitic to say that.
No, that's you know, that's really silly. It's again, if you just dare to question anything, you know, if you dare to question United States, you know, Ukrainian policy, you're pro-Russian or something. That's basically using labels, using stereotypes, using kind of, you know, threatening language, because we know in post-Holocaust era, you know, the term an anti-Semite is like, it's like the term of, you know, you're a baby killer or something. So this is a charged term, and it should be used sparingly and for a good reason. You know, criticizing the policy of any government is absolutely legitimate. Questioning the policy of any government is absolutely legitimate. So It doesn't lead anywhere. What we have to remember is people on the ground there are suffering, are dying, are being bombed, are being threatened, are hiding in shelters or wherever. So they should be stopped rather than sort of, you know, exchanging meaningless kind of labels and throwing them at each other. You are,
yeah, it's pretty low thing to do, I think. But anyway, I mean, this the other thing is it's being framed very much in religious terms between Islam and Judaism, and we've seen scenes of Israeli soldiers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque again. I just wonder whether you think this really, you know, I find it difficult to frame it as a religious or a conflict of faith when you've got soldiers in a mosque.
No, I agree with you. It's politics. It's definitely a very serious social issues. You know, the opportunity for people to grow, to develop. I'm sure that, you know, if Palestinians, both within Israel or in Gaza territory, had possibility to develop economically, they would just, you know, kind of will pursue the improvement of their life rather than doing anything. I think in general, you know, religion is very important for people, but trying to cast things in religious terms, it's another way of obfuscation. You know, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, we had the same in the Northern Ireland conflict between Catholics and Protestants, although actually it was two completely different traditions. It was the, you know, the loyalists and the Republican traditions were not, you know, okay, so they were divided down the lines of the Catholic and Protestant faith, but that wasn't what was driving the conflict at all. It was largely an economic and a cultural conflict. But anyway, look, just to wind up, Vladimir, I wonder if you could tell us how we can follow your work, where we can find you, and if we wanted to study under you, which university we can apply to.
I teach at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and I teach Russian literature, Russian film, and so on. I also sort of, you know, I have my own blog, Vladimir Goldstein. It can be found, and I'm pretty active on Facebook, so wherever I sort of, if I do interview, if I have some kind of musings on culture, on politics, on my recollection about my deja vu recollection of Soviet Union, I usually, you know, put it on Facebook. It's open to everyone. I believe in freedom of speech. This is one of my cherished ideals. I still think that, you know, in the United States, despite all the, problems, it's our moral duty to practice it. And that's what I'm trying to do. So Facebook is the first thing. I also have a page on academia.edu where I have a link to all my scholarly articles. So basically, if you know my name, Vladimir Goldstein, and Goldstein is without letter D, G-O-L-S-T-E-I-N, you'll find me in the internet world.
Now, I notice you and I share an interest in science fiction because you wrote a bit about Zamyatin's book, We, recently. Can we just wind up with you, telling us a bit about that book and why you thought it was an important thing to write about?
It's unbelievably important book because, we have to remember that Zamyatin was actually a Bolshevik who was not happy with Tsarist regime. He was also working at England, actually building icebreakers. So he has a lot of opportunity to explore the West and live in England. Then he comes back to the Soviet Union after revolution and starts seeing some things which he actually didn't like. He starts recognizing certain features of capitalist England, which he didn't like, certain features of Tsarist Russia, which he didn't like. So he imagined that if these bad things are pushed to the limit, then we're going to have this awful, awful kind of autocracy, awful hypocrisy, awful kind of control of the government under this fake pretense that this government is great benefactors, but in fact exploits people and abuses them and suppress anything alternative. So he kind of predicted it. And what is interesting about him, his vision applies to both systems. His vision sort of saw the worst in the Soviet Union, and Orwell recognized it right away, skinned its spirit, and saw that it can be applied sort of all over the world. Because unfortunately, and that's sort of what we all have to be concerned with, this creeping autocracy, creeping big brother who wants to take away your freedoms and turn you into a number, obedient number. It's not just out there in the Soviet Union, out there in China. It's right here in London and New York and Providence and many other places. And that would have to be very well aware. And I think Zamyatin was, he wrote this in 21, 23, 24, very early, much earlier than anybody else. So that was said that he saw this creeping, tyranny already at that time in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, cause I can remember reading it and thinking it was a fantastic. I mean, it was when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and thinking it was brilliant the way that it was. Yeah, it was talking about problems on both sides of the Cold War divide. Anyway, Vladimir Goldstein, thank you very much for joining us again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for talking to me.